The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to another installment of The Dan Proft Show. Follow us at danproftshow.com, on Twitter at Dan Proft Show, and at Dan Proft. And a good piece in Rolling Stone by Andy Krall asks the top line question: are the Democrats completely screwing this up? But it's actually a pretty deep dig, and it's pretty comprehensive in terms of the questions about how Democrat voters are trying to define this difficult, nebulous issue of electability in terms of informing their votes, how the press is understanding their role in the 2020 election, how the new DNC rules that were to empower the grassroots and ensure a diverse, multicultural, multi-generational field did or did not produce such a thing. So for more on this, let's get right to it. Andy Krall, Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for Rolling Stone. Thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Great to be here.
So I like this idea. Everybody throws around these terms and nobody stops to define them or sort of apply some standard by which to make assessments of the various candidates. And one of those words is electability. What is electability when it comes to the Democrat nominee in 2020? It doesn't seem like a lot of the voters you talk to have a handle on it.
They don't have a handle on it. You can talk to five voters in five different early primary states and you'll get five different answers about what electability is or what electability looks like or what it hears like out on the campaign trail. Interesting kind of dichotomy here that I saw. The tension was that when you talk to these Democratic voters, at the end of the day, the thing they really care about most, of course, is a candidate who they think can challenge and defeat Donald Trump in November. On that side of things, there is almost unanimity. But right. Then there's the question, okay, well, what does that actually mean? What does that look like? And it's a complete scatter around, you know, what that would actually take. I think the most honest guy that I talked to when I was writing the story was one who, you know, quoted Socrates and said, I know that I know nothing. I have no idea what electability is, and it's completely impenetrable to me. And I feel like that was the most honest answer anyone could probably give about electability right now.
And also, it doesn't seem like those regular everyday voters are taking their cues from a Democrat establishment that says, at least right now, electability means someone other than Bernie Sanders.
No, I don't think they are taking their cues from that. I mean, I talked to plenty of voters who will give Bernie Sanders a fair look on the electability question, even though they are not part of the revolution movement. They are not 2016 Bernie Sanders supporters. They are not quote unquote Bernie bros. They really are open to anyone. And I really think that, you know, you're onto something there in terms of taking your cues from either the Democratic establishment or just the Democratic Party infrastructure. People aren't doing that as much anymore. The party doesn't have that kind of sway. In some cases, I think it actually dissuades people or it turns people off. And maybe they say, well, this party is pointing me toward, I think I'm going to do the opposite. I think there's still some bitter feelings and there's still some distrust of the Democratic National Committee from the 2016 race. And you see that as well folding into this whole electability question.
Well, the combination of what happened in Iowa plus the rules changes for debates, as well as the appointments to the DNC governing committee in Milwaukee, that hasn't helped build trust, I don't think.
No, it hasn't helped build trust. You know, I'll point out that this story of mine with this headline, you know, our Democrats screwing this up, came out on Sunday before the Iowa caucus. It's never a great feeling to see a state party like the Iowa Democratic Party completely screw up their first in the nation contest, though obviously the headline seems to get more timely afterward in a sort of grim way. No, the things you point out don't engender trust as well. The DNC was supposed to have, I mean, let's start after, real quick, after 2016. There was wide agreement that the DNC needed to rethink its role, that it needed to clean house, that it needed to make reforms to the process. The question is, are the reforms that they put in place for 2020 the right ones? I think the verdict at this point is that they're not. The field is supposed to be multi-generational, diverse, capable of elevating grassroots candidates. That really hasn't been the case. The candidates, apart from Mayor Pete Buttigieg, where the top contenders now are all known quantities, came into the race with big email lists and lots of money in the bank and a network of supporters already. So that's ex-Senator Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders. And obviously the Iowa caucus has shown that maybe replacing Iowa at the front of the line would have been a good idea as well. So I don't think those reforms have helped build trust. I think that the debacle in Des Moines has actually damaged that trust further. And we're going to have another round of DNC changes, maybe a whole another round of cleaning house after this 2020 race, probably, to try to fix these problems yet again.
So the DNC rules and what they've produced, you make an interesting point in your piece. The most powerful people in the primary up to this point have arguably been the pollsters. And what a development that is, that rather than empowering the grassroots and getting the energy up, you're empowering pollsters who, and I know this perception is a little bit inflated, but pollsters who were held up for, you know, being so spectacularly wrong with respect to 2016.
That's the deep irony of it for me. There was a lot of hand-wringing and a little bit of self-reflection after 2016 about how especially state-level polls got it wrong. Why did they get it wrong? There's interesting research, and I've had some really interesting conversations with political consultants that the traditional meat ways of polling just don't work anymore, that in some cases, Trump supporters just don't answer the phone when they talk to pollsters, and so the modern polling technologies don't really reflect the electorate. Yet the DNC ended up going with a criteria that empowered these pollsters and really shaped the field. And I talked to campaign manager of a former Democratic campaign who told me that when they would go to local elected officials in South Carolina, New Hampshire, Iowa, and they'd say, hey, will you endorse our candidate? The candidate would say, or the person they approached would say, well, I really like you and you're doing all the right things. And you just opened that campaign office in my city, in my district. And I think that's great, but you're not polling that well. You really got to do better in the polls. And when you do better in the polls, let me know. And it became this proxy for whether you were a good candidate or not, which, obviously polls reflect in their own semi-warped way the views of the people they spoke with, but they're not the be-all and end-all, and yet that's what they became in the Democratic primary. They became a sign of, is that word again, stability, and they, when candidates couldn't make it to the stage because of polls or donations, that essentially said, you're not really a viable candidate, and it led to the Kirsten Gillibrands, the Cory Bookers, the Julian Castros of the world dropping out of the race, so that's another one of these things I think the DNC's really got to rethink going into the next presidential cycle.
And perhaps even less self-reflective than the DNC or the political parties generally, the media and political journalists and what exactly they understand their role to be other than as political prognosticators. This seems to be also an open-ended question per your piece in Rolling Stone.
Yeah, it's a section of the piece that obviously doesn't make me a lot of friends with my colleagues in the journalism business, but it's pretty shocking if you think about it. Just you stop and say 2016 should have been a heart attack moment for political journalism specifically, one of those major life events where you stop and say, okay, I need to rethink what I've been doing and reassess and come up with a new plan going forward. And there wasn't any of that after the 2016 election for political journalism. There was a little bit of conversation around maybe this should happen, a little bit of a conversation around how did we miss it, but they just moved on. We just moved on. I have to put myself here. And moved on because the next greatest story in the 21st century of American politics had just begun, the presidency of Donald Trump, just after the election of Donald Trump. And I think that was a real missed opportunity. I think there was and still is a real need to figure out a way to cover campaigns and elections that actually gets at what people are thinking and feeling where they live on the ground, and also gets away from the kind of insider horse race journalism that only is kind of comprehensible to a small group of political elites. Maybe it'll happen after 2020, depending on what happens in the 2020 election. But I do think it's one of the big mistakes of our part of the last 4 or 5 years.
He is Andy Kroll. He's the D.C. bureau chief for Rolling Stone. Check out his column, which I'll tweet out. Are the Democrats completely screwing this up? Andy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. The president offered reviews on a broad cross-section of America through Americans who were in the gallery during his State of the Union address. Some very poignant moments, the Presidential Medal of Freedom being conferred to Rush Limbaugh, reuniting of a soldier with his family in the gallery. I mean, some really wild moments, frankly. Also, another one was Paul Morrow, who is a U.S. Army veteran, and he's an owner of a successful contracting business. That contracting business is called SDAC. He was recognized by the president. He's been recognized by a lot of leaders, SBA State of Florida Small Business Person of the Year back in 2017, and a successful businessman, honorably discharged by the military. I mentioned he's a veteran. He's honorably discharged after getting injured. Then he started this business located in Homestead, Florida, and Selma, Alabama. And he's an American success story. The president wanted to point that out, particularly in the context of the things he's done to try to attract investment into otherwise blighted areas and support successful small business owner, operator, entrepreneurs like Paul Morrow, who joins us now. Paul, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning. So, you know, before we get to your big audition on a national stage on Tuesday night, tell us the story of your success as an entrepreneur and your business.
Well, you know, just back up a little bit.
Sure.
I don't know if you can remember, but back in November, the president rallied in Atlanta, Georgia. He called me on the stage to say hi to the people, you know, and it was weird. We were still talking about his opportunity zone. And I got a chance to address the nation from his podium for about 13 minutes on that date.
Mm-hmm.
So it was aired on C-SPAN. But anyway, we'll go ahead and, you know, as an entrepreneur, I started this business back in 1985 out of Homestead, Florida. As a grassroots community air conditioning repair company. And, you know, we kind of expanded out into the local government. Is where I kind of found out where, you know, the kind of problem is. But I had my biggest success as a grassroots air conditioning repair company and then making it to the federal government arenas. If you kind of relate back, you know, to the interview or to the stage speech I had with the president in Atlanta, Georgia, I spoke about becoming a warfighter in 2009, increased to fight against unemployment and poverty in the nation. And I got a hold to a bunch of federal programs that aided my success in being the Entrepreneurship Person of the Year Award for 2017. And that was also a presidential award.
And the Opportunity Zone legislation, that the animating legislation that was the topic of conversation, that allowed you to purchase a part of a 400-acre plot in one of those zones to help grow your business over the last several years, correct?
Yes. Well, we were doing work over in Montgomery at the MacLeod Ford base, and we got other contract with Dana Seal, and we're doing other DDE and MDE stuff with the state of Alabama over there with the roads and highways and paving and stuff like that. But anyway, this spot of land was in Montgomery, available for sale, and we looked into it to purchase it, and then we realized later, you know, they started talking about the Opportunity Zone, that this land was in the middle of the Opportunity Zone over there. So, you know, we purchased the land, you know, and we found out it's a great success in being in position, you know, to create opportunity at these Opportunity Zones. Right now, this land was cow pasturage, farmland, you know, pecan trees and stuff like that. But if you see this land today, we purchased land about 30 or 45 days now. And it's a full construction site. You know, roads, gravel, gravel pits. And they're setting it up to have, you know, the asphalt plant, the concrete plant, and different things over there. But anyway, within the last 35 to 40 days, we done employed about close to 50 people over there. And those people are located at the Opportunity Zone as well.
One of 19 children born to James and Mary Morrow of Plantersville, Alabama. You grew up picking beans, okra, corn, to serving our country in the military, to being an AC repairman, to now being the CEO of a multi-million dollar company. And what does your story tell us about America? What should we know from the Paul Morrow story?
Well, I always had this thought that if a man thinketh, so would that man be. And, you know, so and after that man continued to think, so he remained. So I always thought that I could be somewhere different. And it one famous man, you know, gave a quote that really grabbed my attention. And he said that if one become famous or rich or wealthy, that they didn't do it by themselves. You probably know who that man was. So I'm a firm believer that one man's success is called by the people who we have around him, which is his staff. So in my success story, I have to start out with the way my mother and my father raised me to be responsible for it, you know, to be a responsible human being, you know, like, you know, doing his chores around on. And I went into the military and became a great person because of those aspects of how I grew up. And I learned in the military what the unity and teamwork was all about. So, you know, coming through the ranks, you know, I got the family, friends, and loved ones that were working for me in the air conditioning repair company down in Homestead, starting out. And, you know, if you've seen the story where I fought myself, you know, back to Alabama, you know, it was a God, spiritual thing through him. But anyway, I met some more good people over there in Alabama, and I was able to do greater things, you know, not by myself. It was because of the people I'm bringing around me. And continue to bring, you know, professionals and experts. You know, I learned that the traits of bringing good people around you to achieve great success. So this is how, you know, continue the growth and the success of SDAC. Well, I'm a supporter of anybody that wear the suit that Trump, that Donald Trump is wearing now. They're willing to help peoples, my peoples. You know, because I wake up in a different life, a different reality. I live in the community with the Uncle Funks, you know, with the Soul Dogs, with the Q, you know, these cold blooded killers that walk down the street killing innocent people in our neighborhood. And most political people call them, you know, bad peoples. But, you know, I know that these are not bad people. They're mad people. They don't have opportunities. They don't have money. You know, so they need jobs and need opportunities in their community. So that is my reality that I wake up to every morning. So anybody that's the president of this great nation that is making opportunity for me as a war fighter against those things I just named, then that's my man. That's my person. That's my leader.
All right. Well said.
And with this Opportunity Zone, I'm experiencing where the first time in my career is that he's making a program available to infuse money directly into the community by people like myself. And I feel greater than him. I feel greater than him to be able to present these opportunities to the community.
You saw him on Tuesday night during the President's State of the Union address. He was recognized by President Trump. He is Paul Morrow, the president and founder of the company SDAC. Paul, thanks so much for joining us and sharing your story. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Take care.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. And President Trump speaking at the National Prayer Breakfast today prior to his address to the nation on the issue of his acquittal yesterday had this to say about certain people who pray for him or use their faith as the basis to do something wrong, in his estimation, clearly speaking about Romney and Pelosi.
Weeks ago and again yesterday, courageous Republican politicians and leaders had the wisdom, fortitude, and strength to do what everyone knows was right. I don't like people who use their faith as justification for doing what they know is wrong. Nor do I like people who say, I pray for you, when they know that that's not so. So many people have been hurt, and we can't let that go on.
So let's revisit both of the individuals President Trump was referring to. First, Mitt Romney, and then we'll get to Nancy Pelosi. Again, Mitt Romney, his explanation for his vote to convict on the first article of impeachment on abuse of power.
As a senator juror, I swore an oath before God to exercise impartial justice. I am profoundly religious. My faith is at the heart of who I am. I take an oath before God as enormously consequential. I knew from the outset that being tasked with judging the president, the leader of my own party, would be the most difficult decision I have ever faced. I was not wrong. You see, I support a great deal of what the president has done. I voted with him 80% of the time. But my promise before God to apply impartial justice required that I put my personal feelings and political biases aside. Were I to ignore the evidence that has been presented and disregard what I believe my oath and the Constitution demands of me for the sake of a partisan end, it would, I fear, expose my character to history's rebuke and the censure of my own conscience.
Yeah, it's all very high-minded from Mitt Romney, and I'm not in the business of questioning one's conscience or one's faith, but I am in the business of tracking what people say with what they do, and ultimately your work product matters. And so talking about his faith, I mean, Mitt Romney saying he's nothing if not his faith tradition, right? Well, I mean, just as an example, the Church of Latter-day Saints' position on abortion. Human life is a sacred gift from God. Elective abortion for personal or social convenience is contrary to the will and the commandments of God. Well, Mitt Romney, when he was in his early to mid-40s running for office in Massachusetts, said this: I believe that since Roe v. Wade has been the law for 20 years, we should sustain and support it. And I sustain and support that law and the right of the woman, the right of a woman to make that choice. The same year, 94, when he's running against Ted Kennedy, he and his wife attended a Planned Parenthood fundraiser. 2002, running for Massachusetts governor, he assured voters that he was not going to change our pro-choice, quote, not going to change our pro-choice laws in Massachusetts in any way. I will preserve and protect a woman's right to choose. I'm not going to change our pro-choice laws. I'm not going to make any changes which would make it more difficult for a woman to make that choice herself. Then when he was running for the Republican nomination for president both times, he's a pro-lifer. Was there a evolutionary story associated with that? Not one that I've ever heard. Is he a cafeteria Mormon? Is that the explanation? Like so many cafeteria Catholics and my faith tradition? Maybe. I don't know that I've heard it. What I hear is somebody that is guided by their faith wholly and completely. Not to mention Mitt Romney's on-again, off-again affinity for Trump. Off during the 2016 campaign. On when he was lobbying for to be his Secretary of State. Off after the first 2 years prior to the run-up to him running for Utah, Senator in Utah. On when Trump endorsed his candidacy for Utah Senator. Seems like his faith comes and goes when it is politically convenient for it to either be present or not. When we come back, we'll pick up the other individual that President Trump was talking about. That would be Nancy Pelosi, of course. More on the Dan Prof Show.
Fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Prof, and this is the Dan Prof Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show, talking about what the president had to say at the National Prayer Breakfast this morning. Clearly, without naming them, implicating Mitt Romney and Nancy Pelosi as two people who are perhaps less than genuine about their professions of faith, particularly as it pertains to decisions that relate to him, Mitt Romney, or the treatment of him, Nancy Pelosi. And you'll recall, this is clearly what he's referring to, the idea that Nancy Pelosi prays for the president. Well, sure, you could see that on display at the end of the State of the Union address on Tuesday night, couldn't you? There's no hate in her heart. Remember, it was just a few weeks ago, James Rosen from Sinclair Broadcast Group asking Nancy Pelosi whether or not the impeachment was so much about the personal animus that she has for President Trump. And ultimately, as Nancy Pelosi has wanted to do from time to time, not unlike Mitt Romney, actually, invoke her faith.
Do you hate the president, Madam Speaker?
I don't hate anybody.
I think it's an important
I
point.
I think the president is a coward when it comes to helping our kids who are afraid of gun violence. I think he is cruel when he doesn't deal with helping our dreamers. This is about the Constitution of the United States and the facts that lead to the president's violation of his oath of office. And as a Catholic, I resent your using the word hate in a sentence that addresses me. I don't hate anyone. I was raised in a way that is full, a heart full of love, and always prayed for the president. And I still pray for the president. I pray for the president all the time. So don't mess with me when it comes to words like that.
She's a tough hombre when it comes to her Catholic faith, huh? She's devout. Another expression of the charity and heart full of love that Nancy Pelosi had on the dais on Tuesday night, right? She's Friday Night Lights. Clear eyes and full hearts can't lose. Nancy Pelosi. Goodness grief. Goodness gracious and good grief. I combine the two. Portmanteau. So here's the thing. Going back to Mitt Romney and his argument. You know, that's where the fail is, too. You want to give him the benefit of the doubt, as my friend Randy Barnett, who's a well-respected and a great constitutional scholar at Georgetown Law, tweeting out, before anyone condemns Romney for his vote, they should listen to his 9-minute explanation of the vote as he did, of why he voted as he did. This wasn't an easy vote for him to make politically, and it's possible to have a good faith disagreement about the issue, in particular in Article 1. No, it isn't. I mean, I'm sorry, but no, it isn't, Randy. And no, it wasn't difficult for him politically. What are the political consequences for Mitt Romney? The hashtag Mitt Romney American Hero that's trending on Twitter? The that a boy from the Republican establishment, managerial elite types, business roundtable, chamber of commerce types. What, he's got some Trump supporters that will recoil in horror and take him to task? Well, they weren't with him anyway. And they're not his audience. I mean, Mitt Romney didn't say it in 2012, but don't think that he's far removed from the idea that Trump voters are the deplorables, as a lot of Vichy Republican elites, the spineless set, who just want to be accepted by the ruling class elites in charge of our civic and cultural institutions, secretly desire. Thus, he moves around on all of these issues of fundamental morality, like the life issue I just mentioned. And the on again, off again. I mean, again, it's only January 19. It's a year ago. He wrote a piece in the Post criticizing President Trump. So the president shapes the public character of the nation. Trump's character falls short. Mitt Romney, you know, chapter and verse. This is after the departure of Jim Mattis as Secretary of Defense and John Kelly as White House Chief of Staff. And Mitt Romney joined the chorus of the president's administration is in free fall and chaos, and the president doesn't have the temperament for the position. He's failing us. He's not calling on the greatness of the American spirit, and all the other high-minded rhetoric that people like Mitt Romney employ, even if they don't exemplify. The quality of his argument, just going back to close the loop on Randy Barnett. So I don't see a big political cost for him to pay with respect to the benefits and cost as he's assessing them, you know, his interests. His interests are not the interests of Trump voters. That's fairly clear. Number two, good faith disagreement about the issue on Article 1, abuse of power. I go back to what Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, said at the outset of the presentation of the defense's case before the Senate. There's no good faith disagreement. Not only did Democrats not present a case, they didn't present any charges. There is no colorable claim. The generic abuse of power charge. Right. Again, as many deeper legal scholars than I have argued, that catch-all phrase as the basis to remove a president from office, that every president past and future should have been and could be removed from office by that standard. How is it possible to have a good faith disagreement about a provision in the Constitution so bastardized as compared to the framers' intent that every president past, present, and future could have been or could be removed from office on that basis? It's silliness. And Romney's arguments, in addition to his appeal to faith yesterday, were specious on the merits. False on the merits. From the quote-unquote no crimes committed by the Bidens. What was the investigation into the Bidens? There hasn't been one. Oh, by the way, there's going to be now, as much emphasis as there is on Jerry Nadler saying he's going to subpoena Bolton. Go ahead. Meanwhile, Chuck Grassley wants the Secret Service to provide flight records of Hunter Biden's travels to Ukraine and China to see if he was leveraging public resources for private financial interests. I mean, Romney bought chapter and verse the fact-free assertions of the left and coded it in his faith. It was a disgraceful moment, and that's how history will remember him, since he's so concerned about that, ultimately. This is the Dan Prof Show.
You listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Prof Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show, and this little ditty and offering a review of Pierre Delecto, aka Willard Romney. From an alert listener, Robert Badgley. It's pretty good. Take a listen. Good prose here. He took to Twitter under pseudonym to criticize Trump and take shots at him. Pierre Delecto was his Twitter name, like Carlos Danger, just a bit more tame. To stand athwart history yelling stop is not a posture Willard could adopt. He'd rather jog alongside Democrats and pant and mutter, maybe not so fast. His worldview was informed by Russell Kirk. At bottom, he's an opportunistic jerk. Not exactly Dice Clay, but pretty entertaining. Very, very good, Robert Pesci. Thank you for the contribution to the Dan Prof Show. And isn't that the case? Mitt Romney, I talked a little bit earlier in the hour about his iterations from his time. Well, he started in Michigan, then went to Massachusetts, then, of course, now is in Utah with a couple of presidential runs in between. Always moving around, depending on what the political landscape affords, at least in his interpretation of the political landscape, which has often been less than accurate. But Mitt Romney in 2016, commenting on the prospect of a Trump presidency. 2016 campaign, Mitt Romney.
And let me put it very plainly. If we Republicans choose Donald Trump as our nominee, the prospects for a safe and prosperous future are greatly diminished. But you say, wait. Isn't he a huge business success? Doesn't he know what he's talking about? No, he isn't. And no, he doesn't. Here's what I know. Donald Trump is a phony, a fraud. His promises are as worthless as a degree from Trump University.
It must have been fun writing those lines back in 2016. How have they held up? Do you feel like you're in control, Mitt Romney? They're not laughing now, are they? Mitt Romney, after meeting with President Trump when he was auditioning, so that's Mitt Romney on candidate Trump. Now Mitt Romney on President Trump, auditioning to be a Secretary of State.
I had a wonderful evening with President-elect Trump. We had another discussion about affairs throughout the world, and these discussions I've had with him have been enlightening and interesting and engaging. I've enjoyed them very, very much.
Boy, real change of tune. And that's the one thing Romney is good at, changing his tune in furtherance of his own relevance. And that's what really animates Mitt Romney. This is the Dan Prof Show.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Prof Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Again, you can follow us at danproftshow.com, also on Twitter at Dan Proft, and or at Dan Proft Show. We talked about this piece in American Greatness yesterday, this piece from Angelo Codevilla, Professor Emeritus from Boston U, about the revolution against the ruling class and the ruling class's intolerance, not just of the 2016 election results, as Codevilla argues, but also of those who provided those results. In other words, the deplorables, the credulous boomer rubes. Codevilla, again, I can't overstate the significance of this stark description being provided by Codevilla, who again coined the term or is credited in part with coining the term ruling class and was well ahead of the learning curve with respect to what happened in 2016. He writes, our country is in a state of revolution irreversibly because society's most influential people have retreated into moral autarky, have seceded from America's constitutional order, and because they browbeat their socio-political adversaries instead of trying to persuade them. This is not a choice that can be reversed. It's a change in the character of millions of people. And I wanted to pick it up there with our next guest, Michael Lind, who's a professor of practice at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin, fellow at New America, author of the new book, The New Class War, Saving Democracy from the Managerial Elite. Michael Lynn, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So before we get to some of the specifics or maybe weave in what you describe, what you outline in terms of where we're at, how do you react to that description offered by Coda Vita of where we're at?
Well, I think if you include bloodless revolutions, then we are, as I say in the beginning of my book, The New Class War, in a revolution which so far, except in France with the Yellow Vest riots, mm-hmm. Has been nonviolent. It's a revolution on both sides of the Atlantic, and you see very similar pattern of alienated, largely but not entirely, white working class folks, many of them in former industrial regions like the U.S. Rust Belt, the British so-called Red Wall in northern England, similar parts of Britain and France, turning to populist candidates and movements. And at the same time, the left, which used to be based on the industrial workers in the private sector, has recomposed itself as a coalition of elite college-educated whites, minorities, and immigrants. So in the new class war, I argue that this is not just an American phenomenon. It's something seen throughout Western democracies.
And the professional class, that managerial elite you're talking about, this isn't predicated so much on income as it is education.
Yes, that's right. I follow James Burnham, the ex-socialist who became one of the founders of William F. Buckley Jr.'s National Review in the 1950s, in arguing that the dominant class, the ruling class in advanced industrial societies, is not the capitalists, that is, investors or owner-operators of small business. It's credentialed managers, not simply of private corporations, though those are very important, but also in the media, in universities and nonprofits, in government and in the military and diplomatic services. In modern societies, your power is largely a function of your authority within one of these huge bureaucratic hierarchies, whether they're public or private. And access to that depends not just on a diploma, but usually on an advanced professional degree of some kind.
And so the elites, by your definition, too, would include something like the public sector unions. I mean, for example, let's say just in Chicago, if you are a Chicago public, a Chicago teacher union boss, or even in the hierarchy of the administration of the Chicago public school system, then you have sway over 350,000 kids, and that's real political power.
Well, there's a big difference between public sector unions and private sector unions. Historically, private sector unions represented working class people with only high school educations, simply because government jobs generally go to people who have college diplomas, and that's certainly the case with teachers. So teachers, it is true they are paid less than other professionals, but they are paid much more than high school educated working class people on average in the U.S. So, you know, there's been some criticism. How can you say a teacher is part of the ruling elite? But my point is not that every teacher is rich or that every high school educated contractor is poor, but rather this is the major social cleavage in our country. It's the diploma divide.
And in the new class war, your book, you seem to suggest that this managerial elite doesn't need to be sort of overthrown necessarily, but they do need to share power with those who are not of their ilk, and I guess mainly based on the level of education. How does that come to pass? The old adage that power isn't given, it's taken, right?
Exactly. As I point out in the new class war, half a century ago, there were organizations which the elites of that time did not particularly like either, trade unions, religious and civic organizations, grassroots religious organizations that sort of policed the media in Hollywood. And in the political realm, you had local political party machines and courthouse gangs the parties were still federations of local and state chapters, not just brands that can be purchased by rich people, which is kind of what they've become. And all of these were human institutions. There were corrupt unions. There were crooked party bosses. You know, there were silly church ladies. But these organized labor, local political machines, and these religious and civic groups gave working class people influence in the three realms of the economy, the culture, and politics. And as those institutions have disintegrated for various reasons, power has siphoned up to the college-educated, professional, and managerial elite to which I belong. And in the absence of some kind of mass membership organizations that can mobilize the only asset that working class people have, which is their numbers, their role in politics is essentially that of spectators who every few years maybe they cast a possibly meaningless vote. And that's a major change in the last half century.
But so then, just going back to Codavilla, his prescription for what he describes as this ongoing revolution is basically to hurt the other side until it loses the capacity and the will to do us harm. That means treating institutions and people from the standpoint of our own adversarial interests, controlling what we can, either for our own use or for bargaining purposes, discrediting and abandoning what we cannot take from our enemies. I don't think he's talking about violence here, of course, but he is certainly talking about a frontal assault on those institutions and, by extension, the managerial elite you described that are in control of them.
Well, I haven't read his work, and so I can't speak for it. My own view is that a frontal assault is likely to fail until you have built up these countervailing institutions once again, and that's not a matter of one election or two elections. That's a matter of decades of a patient effort, because if you don't have institutions that exist between elections that can mobilize pressure from working class people outside of the political realm, for example, if in terms of the culture and the media or the workplace, then, you know, simply hoping that there, it's almost like a conservative version of Bernie Sanders' revolution. You know, there are all these great, well, how's it going to happen? Well, the people will rile up and get angry, and there will be a revolution and overthrow the bad guys. My premise is much more realistic. We're always going to have managers. We need a managerial elite. They play an essential role in the country in terms of their technical skills, but they need to be restrained from lording it over everyone else. And the best way to do that is to create organizations that can balance their power in the workplace, in the culture, and in government.
When we come back, I want to pick up on some of the criticisms of this sort of this class war argument from both the left and the sort of establishment right. We're talking to Michael Lind. He's a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at UT and the author of the new book, The New Class War, Saving Democracy from the Managerial Elite. We'll be right back with more Professor Lind. You can never.
Good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. We're speaking with Professor Michael Lind from the School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of the new book, The New Class War, Saving Democracy from the Managerial Elite. I wanted to pick up on the conversation we were having, Professor, about the institutions that those who are not part of the managerial elite need to cobble together to essentially demand a bit of more of a power-sharing relationship with those managerial elites that aren't going away, but can perhaps reform their own character. Eric Hoffer, the speaking of non-managerial elites, the longshoreman turned philosopher, said in order to have a mass movement for change, you basically need people to subscribe to two things. One, that they're in control of their own destiny, and two, that they have it within their power to improve their conditions. Otherwise, they're likely to sort of default to the status quo because they're concerned things could get worse. Because of the economy's performance in particular under President Trump, are you seeing sort of the dynamics that Hoffer suggested must be there for a mass movement, for a paradigm shift? Are you seeing that environment as conducive to the sort of paradigm shift that you describe needs to happen in your book?
Well, yes and no. It is the case that what historians call the revolution of rising expectations tends to lead to reform from below for exactly the reason you point out. If people are completely flat on their backs, they're not going to do anything. It's when conditions are appearing to get better that that's when you have revolutions. The French Revolution, you know, the American Revolutions, people weren't destitute. They were getting better, but they were just being thwarted. So that could be a factor. But in the new class war, I argue that given the elitist nature of our system, grassroots rebellion is not enough. You have to have a significant portion of the managerial elite has to break with the rest of the ruling establishment and side with ordinary people and trying to build up a new system where power is shared more broadly. And that can be done because members of the elite are frightened by populism from below, by the specter of socialism or something like that. Usually, as I point out in my book, it's the desire to mobilize the country in competition with other societies, for example, during World War II and the Cold War. In that case, you have the more patriotic members of the elite, and some of them are patriots, saying, look, we can't have the country being torn apart over class or race or other cleavages. You know, we're a team. We have to work together. And in the case of the elite, that means sharing some of your wealth and privileges and power.
And so you mentioned race. So sort of the racial anxiety argument that explains the Trump phenomenon coming from the left. This was a concern that white people were losing their status in America, and that's what explains the Trump election in 2016. Worried about their racial position of power and privilege, and worried about American culture from the white man, particularly the white man's perspective. That's what the left argues in many quarters. Is that just a way of trying to keep those managerial elites that you're describing from breaking away and being open-minded about a power-sharing arrangement like you're describing?
Well, yes, and it's obviously wrong. That's not to say you don't have residual racism and ethnic resentment, both in the U.S. and in Western Europe, but it has been constantly declining since the Civil Rights Revolution. And you also can't explain sudden events like the populist revolts that led to Trump's election and Brexit and the French Yellow Vest riots in terms of a constant. A constant cannot explain a variable. It's quite clear if you look at the maps of Europe and the U.S. that the populist revolt is based in former industrial regions that were hit very hard by offshoring, subsidized Asian imports, and that the social base of it consists of the private sector, former unionized working classes, who were formerly the base of the center-left parties in the West, of the Democrats in America, Labor in Britain, and the Social Democrats in Germany. What has happened is this parties of the center-left now represent disproportionately the wealthy and affluent and well-educated, along in some cases with minorities and immigrants in big cities. So, you know, these social changes in the composition of the parties explain a lot more than a supposed spontaneous outburst of racism in the U.S. and Britain and France and Germany.
And so what about within the Republican Party itself, the party to which Trump affiliates, obviously? the response to his State of the Union address in part from the Chamber of Commerce Business Roundtable type Republicans was, oh, he's not telling the truth about immigration. And this was a president basically just framed what he's doing, not just in the terms of border security and the rule of law, talking about sanctuary cities and the like, but also just this idea. Here's sort of a principle. Taxpayer benefits are for U.S. citizens. They're not for people in this country illegally. If we're going to decide, if we're going to continue this idea that there is something special about being a U.S. citizen versus not being one, and there's a process to become one, even though we're still open-minded to allowing people to pursue that process. And that's a position that is rejected not just by AOC and the socialist left these days. It's also sort of, if not rejected formally, it's sort of dismissed by the Chamber of Commerce Republicans. And so how does this power sharing arrangement, how does it work even just within sort of center right ranks with that real chasm between the non-managerial elites and the managerial elites?
Well, what you see in politics on both sides of the Atlantic is the people who were the free market conservatives, the managerial elite, business class types, the country club Republicans in parties of the center right, 10 or 20 or 30 years ago, increasingly are voting for center left parties, or at least their children are. At the same time, the Republicans in the United States, certainly the conservatives in Britain under Boris Johnson, are becoming more and more of a blue-collar party. And as the conservative parties become more working class and less business and professional class, they tend to reflect the interests and values of those workers. Back when the Democrats were primarily a white working class party, they were skeptical about mass immigration. It was the Republican business elites that wanted to bring in cheap labor from abroad. So now that those former Democrats are voting for Republicans, they have brought with them their historic skepticism about employer-friendly immigration schemes and employer-friendly offshoring. At the same time, in the last decade, as the Democrats have become more upscale, they have inherited what used to be the moderate Republican views.
Interesting analysis, provocative analysis, and compelling book. The New Class War, Saving Democracy from the Managerial Elite is the book. Michael Lynn, professor of practice at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin, is the author. Professor Lynn, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I came to get down. I came to get down. So get out your seat and jump around. Jump around. Jump around. Jump around. Jump up, jump up and get down. Jump, 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 jump.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
On this edition of Campus Beat, talked to Sam Abrams from Sarah Lawrence College last week, offering a bit of an optimistic note about the new crop of students that actually do come to him, even though he is a center-right conservative on the campus of Sarah Lawrence, very liberal institution. But they're coming to him, he says. They want to hear the arguments. They want to hear both sides. They're not so closed off. He's taking this as an encouraging sign, particularly since he was somebody targeted by the left for his research that just identified how lopsided the ideological distribution of administrators on college campuses around the country really is, like by a factor of 12, 13, 14, 20 to 1, left to right. Well, our guest today, Mark Bauerlein, who's a professor of English at Emory, is not so sanguine per this piece that he wrote for American Greatness, amgreatness.com. He essentially makes the argument that conservatives are missing the point of what's happening on college campuses, that this is not a battle for ideas. This is not about simply winning arguments. It's about filling positions, literally. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Professor Bauerlein. Professor, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
I'm glad to talk.
So, you know, your argument is the old reminder that personnel is policy to some extent, including on college campuses.
That's right. And if you want to see how ineffectual the argument and the ideas pushed forward by conservatives, you just have to look at the late 80s when the academic culture wars broke out. Alan Bloom's book, The Closing of the American Mind, 1987, huge bestseller. And it convinced the public very well that there was a big problem on college campuses. Follow-up books by Dinesh D'Souza and Roger Kimball showed political correctness is taking over the campus. And they won the public battle for that. The public understanding of the campus is quite clear that it is politically skewed. Now, that was 30 years ago. Question, has political correctness gotten worse or better on college campuses? It has never been worse than it is today. And here's the funny thing. My good, moderate, liberal colleagues are frightened. They know that they need to watch their mouth. They better not tell the wrong joke. They better not include anything in their syllabi that could trigger or upset all different groups of students. So this shows that the debate can be won and you can still lose the institution.
Well, there's a word for what you're describing, too, with your left of center academic friends. That comes to us from Lee Jessam, who's a social psychology professor at Rutgers. Wokenibalism. Wokenibalism. This is a new word. A low-carb, high-protein diet consisting mainly of eating your own. And he's got a huge glossary of terms that describe what's happening mainly in on college campuses in academia. And just the fact that he came up with this glossary of terms speaks to what you're saying. And here's the thing. You know, conservatives, myself included, we like to say, oh, look at what Jonathan Haidt and Mark Lilla are doing with heterodox, and look at what you're describing with, you know, colleagues that are left being targeted by those that are, you know, the real cultural Marxists who have no quarter for dissent of any sort. And this is an awakening that's happening that ultimately is going to shift the paradigm on college campuses. But what I hear you saying is no. That's actually not what's going to happen.
No, it's not. I mean, I've been hearing this for 30 years. Oh, you know, the tide is going to turn. The pendulum is going to swing back. Well, look, we didn't have trigger warnings and microaggression theory 10 years ago.
Right.
These things were unknown. Now you've got students who are demanding that on course evaluations, there be a question now that asks students, did this professor say or do anything that displayed any discrimination against any historically disadvantaged group? Look, this is worthy of communist countries. This is not a college campus. This is people conducting surveillance over one another. And it's spreading. It's not retreating.
When we come back, I want to pick up this discussion and ask you if there is sort of any avenue of hope or reform, or if we should just, all flee to Hillsdale College. We're talking to Mark Bauerlein, professor of English at Emory. We'll be back with more.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
We're back with Mark Bauerlein. He's the professor of English at Emory University, and we're talking about whether or not there is hope that any hope whatsoever that college campuses, at least some more of them than at present, could become actual marketplaces of ideas and small L places, liberal institutions again. And there's real divided opinion on this. Amy Wax, who's a professor of law at Pennsylvania University, said to me that basically you should just shut down the Ivy League schools and start over, that there is no hope, there is no rescue for them. Extend beyond the Ivy League, professor, and what's your sense of any avenue for hope, reform, expanding intellectual diversity, any progress to be made?
Well, here's what I think is happening. In some senses, the university is changing itself from a world of broad liberal education into a zone of biomedical, technological, industrial complex. They're investing more and more in the sciences, especially in the biomedical sciences, and the humanities, where these problems are most acute, they're shrinking. I mean, students are voting with their feet. They're fleeing these humanity courses. The history major in the last 10 years is down 33%. English, philosophy, foreign languages, they're down about 22-23%. So resources are just shifting away, and the humanities have become a marginal part of the undergraduate experience for most students at this point. And the college presidents are happy to shift because they know that these other places, professors who are spouting their Marxist nonsense, they're not bringing in any money. They're not attracting any students. And I think they're withering all by themselves. Now,
but that's sort of
apart from that, whole thing is lost.
So that's the top line conclusion.
I don't see any, because they control personnel, they control hiring, they have a lock on who gets in, who gets accredited. They chase away people who don't conform to the dogma. I don't see any way of breaking that up.
So all I can say is
that students, there are little programs popping up that are great books, that are Western Civ programs, outside the normal department channels. There are good things happening at Clemson, at University of Texas Austin, at Princeton. But they're outside the mainstream. Students can find them, and if they want to contact me, I'm happy to direct any student. They can get my email off the Emory English Department website, and I'm happy to advise them on where to go. But it's almost like, you know, these little monasteries created in the bigger world, and you have to seek them out.
Yeah, and even what you're describing in terms of the shift away towards more profitable academic and research pursuits, frankly, away from the humanities to sort of STEM, to use a handle. What you're describing, that's not good news, because to the extent that the were you to rescue the humanities, what are you rescuing when you have the majority of the top 50 universities in the country, their English departments or English major does not require reading Shakespeare? So, you know, the humanities have been gutted, so there's nothing to salvage effectively.
It's a terrible loss for the kids to go through your college experience, your formation of your character, your taste, your sensibility, not to know what Hamlet says, not to read, you know, Wordsworth's nature poems, not to read the great novels of Jane Austen and Leo Tolstoy. What an impoverishment for them.
And
terrible, and none on the left will say it, because they don't want them to read these things, because that means they have to start recognizing greatness. They have to start realizing that we have a great Western culture inheritance, and they don't want it. They want to kill it.
And the funders, including the donor class for the elite universities, I mean, they're the same people who fund the cultural and artistic institutions in big urban centers. So I'm in Chicago. So the same people that fund Northwestern University of Chicago fund the Lyric Opera, fund the Shakespeare Theater. Don't they see what's going to happen to the Shakespeare Theater? What Shakespeare? Or the Lyric Opera a generation or two from now, when all of those classics have been eliminated from the curriculum everywhere?
Well, I think what happened in the course of the 1970s is that the donor class, the big Republican supporters, they gave up on the humanities. Maybe they were so traumatized by the 60s, They gave up and they went all in on law and economics. It was all about training a generation at the Federalist Society. And they did wonderful things. It's a great success story. And they did bring up people, you know, through different ideas about limited government and so on. But culture, humanities, history, literature, the arts, oh, we'll just give a little money to the Lyric Opera, which is a great institution. We'll give money to them, and that'll do it. They don't think about the educational side of culture. It's just not on their radar.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, it's interesting, the Federalist Society and its impact on the Trump administration with the vetting and essentially clearinghouse for judicial nominees, not just to the Supreme Court, but to the lower federal courts as well, and how prolific President Trump has been with personnel, to your point.
Right.
It seems like what you're describing maybe is the need for a Federalist Society for the humanities.
That'd be nice, but the universities have a lock on the training grounds in a way that the Federalist Society was able to. The Federalist Society sends people out into the real world. The humanities make professors who go back into the humanities. So it's a very insulated environment. That's why the pipeline is on a stranglehold, and they're very good at it. Let's be clear. The left, when it comes to matters of personnel, the left runs circles around the right. Look at how many Obama people are still in the Trump administration.
Yeah, yeah. That's a really good point. The personnel point is a really good point, and the ecosystem, especially for academics, right? If you're going to be quietly frozen out of the prospect of getting a tenured position at an institution, then how do you change something from the inside if you can't get in? That's a really good question. It's sort of a dismal one, Mark. Barline is a professor of English at Emory University. Mark, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Take care.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. And, of course, we spend a lot of time focused on the federal, but so much of life is impacted by government at the state and local. And sometimes responses are needed when local governments, local units of government, overreach. Deregulation needed at the local and state level, even in states that are otherwise doing well economically. And that takes us to Hillsborough County, Florida. This from Reason Magazine. This is a sheriff's office sting in Hillsborough County, Florida. Operation House Hunters. This is to snag handymen doing work without a license. Unsuspecting handymen are lured into one of five homes where undercover deputies film them performing or agreeing to perform prohibited tasks like painting or installing recess lighting without the proper credentials. You know, of course, the sheriff's office has to characterize this sting as all con men. These 118 con men and women posing as contractors, preying on innocent homeowners in Hillsborough County, who are just looking to repair or improve their home. That's not necessarily, you know, an accurate depiction of the situation. They released a compilation video. Some of the handymen caught up in the sting, including several who had passed criminal convictions or had been caught previously performing unlicensed contract work. But the bulk of the charges were for unlawful acts in the capacity of a contractor. Repeat violations can result in a felony. They're otherwise misdemeanor charges. Criminal defense attorney in Tampa said the real con men that are trying to trick homeowners are usually too experienced to get caught up in one of these types of sting operations. So the stings tend to catch someone that crosses the line in an unsophisticated way. Frequently, she says, officers will hire a handyman on the pretext of performing work that doesn't need a license, and then during the course of the job, ask them to do something that does, like unhooking a toilet or laying some tiles. When the handyman says no, then the undercover detective moves the conversation to something else, then comes back to the question later in a different way. By that time, the handyman gets to the location. They want to make the homeowner happy and end up agreeing to perform the work that they didn't intend on doing when they first arrive. So the undercover detective is just sort of creating a crime. So it was like a process crime, creating a crime that probably wouldn't have occurred otherwise. And you see this over and over again in terms of the enforcement of occupational licensing, whether it's contractors or hair braiders, as Reason points out. Hair braiders are a more famous example of onerous regulatory burdens. And it's often much more about protecting incumbent businesses and government licensing revenue than it is actually about protecting the public from fraud. Yeah, you know, the licensure as sort of so quality control by the local government, that all sounds well and good. But oftentimes, as with respect to the hair braider situation, that the requirements to obtain the license are onerous through the expense of going to school to get the proper or the training to get the proper licensure. And, you know, these people want to do work. So just because you're doing unlicensed work doesn't mean you're doing shoddy work. Just because you're doing unlicensed work doesn't mean you're committing fraud. Most of the people caught up in this sting, first-time offenders. And, you know, oh, by the way, if you want to build a business, what's the way you do it? By effectively serving your customers. This is the Dan Prof Show.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Prof Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to another installment of the Dan Proft Show. Follow us at danproftshow.com, on Twitter, at Dan Proft Show, and at Dan Proft. And, have you seen Created Equal yet? And this is the new documentary on Clarence Thomas. I saw this weekend, this past weekend, and it was very good. If you have read his autobiography, My Grandfather's Son, it's largely an illustration of it, but you still have extended interviews with both Clarence Thomas and Ginny Thomas, and there's some, you know, a deep dig into his family life. But really, the face-to-camera talking to Clarence Thomas is the most powerful part of the documentary. In addition to you know, remembering some of the indelible moments from his confirmation hearing that turn out to be relevant today, not just in the context of confirmation hearings for Supreme Court justices and how politicized that has become, but also because it was Joe Biden that was chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And some of the exchanges between Biden and Thomas are hysterical, as well as his commentary in real time today on those exchanges. None too complimentary to Joe Biden, and deservedly so. One of the people profiled in the documentary that we've had on the show before, but I didn't realize he was as instrumental in Clarence Thomas's intellectual development as a colleague as he clearly is, per the way he's treated in the documentary, is Ken Masugi, senior fellow at the Claremont Institute, former speechwriter for Clarence Thomas when he was chairman of the EEOC. Ken, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's great to be back with you.
By the way, your Twitter handle, Japanese American, that's got to be a reference to Harry Jaffa, right?
That's right. Glad you picked that up.
I love it. I love New Birth of Freedom is one of like the definitive work on Lincoln, as far as I'm concerned. To tell us about Clarence Thomas. I don't know if you've had the chance to see the documentary, but you probably don't need to because of your relationship with him. But it's such an important he felt this was important to do now to set some of the record straight, you know, almost three decades after ascending to the high court. And I just wanted to get your, as somebody who knows him as well as you do, wanted to get your perspective on that.
Yes, I did see the movie, in fact, just 2 days ago. I agree with you in its assessment. And the odd thing about it is that it's not just a movie for conservatives. A couple liberal columnists in the Washington Post both praised it very highly. So I think it's a movie that that will appeal to people across the spectrum, but of course conservatives are going to really love it, especially, as you say, for the drubbing it gave Joe Biden, not by attacking him directly, but just by showing him on film. Our theater just burst out in laughter whenever he spoke to Thomas. Thomas actually taught me and John Marini and everyone who was on his staff a great deal about both personal conduct and political insight. Even though I had never worked in Washington before, I had written about Washington as a professor, but never had I actually worked in Washington. And he actually hired me to give me experience in Washington so I could write more effectively about it. And he liked the things I wrote on civil rights issues and on other issues as well, because I connected them with really transcendent issues about American politics. And so he asked me to join him, and it was an extraordinary experience. He's one of the great mentors of my life, and I was glad to do whatever I could for him. I wrote memos about various subjects that he asked me to write about, and he didn't have me involved in the EEOC at all, of which he was chairman. That's the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, a civil rights enforcement agency. Instead, he wanted me to think about various issues that came up. It could be something like just the concept of rights in general, and this was back in 1986 when I joined him, the decrease in civility in our society. And so issues that weren't directly, may not have been directly involved in the running of this very important agency that was experiencing some terrible management problems over the ages. It's always been an agency that was mismanaged until Thomas took it over, and he ran it for record number of years.
Yeah, that's such an important point, and it comes across in the film. It comes across in his autobiography as well. But the idea, because he doesn't ask very many questions, it was a decade before he asked a question on the bench during oral hearings before the court. It goes back to what the press tried to brand him right when he was nominated by H.W. Bush. It's just, this is just a token. You're replacing Thurgood Marshall. He has to choose a black judge. You're a black judge who's conservative. That's the only reason you're being chosen. When in point of fact, you find out in the film that this is somebody who loves intellectual battle, that was engaged with colleagues in debating all of these salient issues in his 20s and 30s, and that continued, of course, when he was appointed to the D.C. Circuit. And oh, by the way, just because he doesn't ask any questions, he's also authored 600 opinions during his time on the bench, more than anybody else during that period. So this is actually truly a man of letters, a thoughtful guy, a deep thinker, and somebody who's quite prolific.
Right. And he doesn't simply write, but he persuades people to his point of view, which is really remarkable, that given that justices on the court are likely to be pretty set in their thinking. But what Thomas has done using the resources that we discussed at the when we were at the EEOC, that is the American founding, the principles of the Declaration of Independence. This gives someone a different take on how to understand the law in a more comprehensive way. It's deeply related to the issue of slavery in America. So Thomas understood slavery not as some abstraction in a book or political slogan, but via his heritage, by his through his family. And so he has a firsthand, or you could say a familial association with tyranny that very few people in America would have. Perhaps an immigrant might, but that's real tyranny, not just a slogan. And how to get out of it without creating more problems than there were before is the great struggle that people had in abolishing slavery. It wasn't all that simple, either opposing slavery or abolishing it. You might think the moral case is clear cut, certainly Lincoln did, but what to do about it is a whole other difficult question.
Fast forwarding from Lincoln to present day, as you do in a recent piece you wrote for American Greatness, amgreatness.com, You discuss the American left's inability to distinguish between tragedy and farce. And you contrast that with Lincoln, who understood that his call for national unity was from a place of national failure at the time, meaning the institution of slavery. So,
right.
So what are you getting at there exactly?
Well, what Lincoln did is to point out the real issue, which is, do we believe in the Declaration of Independence? That is, that all men are created equal, as the basis of our political way of life? Or do we dismiss it as a slogan, or say that, as Stephen Douglas did and as a lot of people today say, well, it just means the equal rights of being British? Well, Lincoln dismissed that, well, and to his political advantage, because there were French and Germans and other immigrants in his audience. And he said, well, I guess Stephen Douglas doesn't think you deserve to be part of heritage of the Declaration of Independence because you're not British. And with that logic, he persuaded people of immigrant stock, people who came over, whose ancestors came over far earlier, that if you're going to exclude some human beings, even slaves or the freedmen, then you may well be excluding yourself.
He is Ken Masugi, senior fellow at the Claremont Institute, former speechwriter in part for Clarence Thomas when he was chairman of the EEOC. Ken, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Okay.
Good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. This is sort of a remarkable story. I guess it's not remarkable in these times, but I can't help but be a little surprised every time I hear a story like this. We talked about it a little bit earlier in this week, the story of how Brad Palumbo, who's a writer for WashingtonExaminer.com, essentially sort of got pushed out of an LGBTQ soccer club in Washington, D.C. Not because he's gay, because that would, my pardon, LGBT soccer club, but because he doesn't have the right political thoughts, philosophical thoughts, and this became an issue in order to play soccer with other people. For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by Brad Palumbo, Deputy Contributors Editor at WashingtonExaminer.com. Brad, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I want to talk a little politics, particularly about Mayor Pete there, who I call Mannequin Pete, but you get the gist, in a minute. But to tell us this story about, you know, young guy, want to stay active. Apparently you like soccer, even though I don't consider it a sport. And so you join this soccer club in D.C., and then somebody finds out that, oh, my God, you may believe in things like tax cuts.
Yeah, so I've been a soccer player my whole life. I'll agree to disagree with you on that one. But I've been a soccer player my whole life. It's one of the things I love to do, especially, you know, I'm a columnist here in Washington, D.C., and so when I'm not working, which isn't very often, I'm trying to do things that have absolutely nothing to do with politics, right? Mm. So whether that means watching silly TV shows or playing soccer, that was the goal, right? I could join a league, make some friends, I was new to the city, and I guess in hindsight, it was naive of me, right? Because I am, like you, a public commentator. My views are out in the public. I'm not woke. I'm not politically correct. And sadly, you know, it's the liberal LGBT crowd that has become stunningly intolerant. I am around conservatives all the time, some of whom are very accepting of gay people and some of whom have socially conservative views, but they hold them to themselves, right? And I've almost never felt ostracized or targeted, right? I would have no concerns if I joined a conservative league with Republican staffers or something, that they would care that I was gay. That, to me, I think there's a very low chance that would happen. However, in this liberal league, as soon as they found out that I say, oh, don't think seven-year-olds should take puberty blockers, and think that Leather Kink Weekend in Washington, D.C. is not the best look for the gay community. As soon as they found my columns where I make those arguments, boy, I was persona non grata.
Well, the interesting thing you point out in your piece as well, describing this progression, is that it was really the younger people in the league that were the most intolerant and whipped into a frenzy about your views. Some of the older guys, and I don't know if gals too, in the league, didn't necessarily rally to your fence, but they sort of didn't want to participate in it. They were trying to make this about soccer and not politics too.
Yeah, so it's really interesting because this gave me insight in kind of the generational gap in the woke crowd, in that like a lot of liberal older gay guys, I mean, they came of age in a very different time, right? So they're used to being around people that they don't necessarily agree with on everything. And they might be Democrats, but they're not snowflakes, right? Whereas these young liberal gay activists and these people who a lot of them work in politics or work in nonprofit worlds for progressive causes, they have really grown up in this coddled, kind of politically correct. They went to, I'm sure, social justice infused college campuses, and they've been taught that people who disagree with you on many issues, it's actually not just a disagreement. It's a threat to your personhood, which is really jarring and disturbing, right? Because I mentioned this in the essay, which is at Quillette.com, but I will say I never talked about politics at these events, right? I was polite to everyone. I never brought anything up. I never chimed in, even when they were all talking about how they loved Elizabeth Warren. I choked down my vomit and didn't say anything.
Yeah.
I was punished and sanctioned for thought crime, right? Private thoughts or thoughts that I expressed in another context, not my behavior in this league, but they pushed me out of this league because I had the wrong thoughts. And that could come right out of 1984, if you ask me.
Well, and also, too, I mean, this is sort of the culture now, too. Andrew Sullivan, writing in New York Magazine last year, Andrew Sullivan, who's sort of a first or second maybe generation gay rights activist and accomplished writer in his own right, so, you know, he argued, look, we all live on a college campus now. And this is sort of an example of what he's talking about as someone who also doesn't think you can just sort of identify. If you can just identify with as to whatever you want to be, gender wise or orientation wise, and you're moving around all the time, well, then, you know, what's the value of the person who was authentically LGBT, or B, but mostly LG? I'm getting all these letters, but you know what I'm saying. It's the I'm actually a woman, and you know, being a first, second, third wave feminist is different than showing up one day like Caitlyn Jenner saying, you know, I'm with you, sister. I'm one of you. There's a difference there, and that's sort of what Andrew Sullivan has argued as well. But that is not consistent with the orthodoxy of the left, particularly down the age demographic. And there are real consequences that they want to mete out, and they're looking. And this is the other thing. Anthony Esselin makes this point, too. You know, if you're an honest person, you're just somebody that, you know, wants to be treated as you treat your neighbor, and you want to live sort of in a peaceful, pluralist society, you're not always looking to jackpot your fellow man or woman. And what these individuals do, like you're describing, they're always looking to jackpot somebody. They're always, you know, commissioning Christopher Steele to do a dossier workup on you.
Yeah, absolutely. They really do. And I guess I agree with Andrew Sullivan. You know, I'm familiar with his work. But really, you're not allowed to question anything on the transgender issue. You can't even make one peep, or you are just absolutely targeted. Like, I am not an anti-trans person. I don't care if adults want to go do their thing. Really doesn't affect me or bother me too much. The only things I have ever said are that I'm concerned about the idea of young children being pushed into this or having irreversible medical changes made that's really alarming. And then the only other thing I've said is, okay, I mean, live how you want if you're an adult, but biological sex does exist, right? So you can't just have biological males in women's sports and expect there to be no unfairness, right? So I've made a couple points like this. It's not even like a total rejection of the dogma or anything, but you can't question any of it, or you are targeted on these transgender and gender-related issues. And I think it's because they know that it's the weakest part of the LGBT platform, right? Most Americans now, even if they have their own personal religious views, are perfectly happy living in a pluralistic society alongside gay and lesbian people. You live your life and I'll live my life. But the plank of the platform that the progressive LGBT crowd is pushing around gender and transgender, a lot of it goes way too far for most people. And I think they know that, which is why they viciously try to squash dissent.
Have you found a new soccer club yet?
No. And in fact, I just actually got kicked off of my other team. I had one team I played on outside of this league, and I got kicked out of this one, too, for similar reasons.
He is Brad Palumbo. He's the deputy contributors editor at Washington Examiner, WashingtonExaminer.com, and he's looking for a new soccer club to join if you know any in the greater D.C. area. Brad, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. So blow, Seminole wind. Blow like you're never gonna blow again. I'm calling to you like a long-lost friend, but I know who you are.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. And Nancy Pelosi, much in the news for all kinds of obvious reasons. You know, she does have her own election. It's not unheard of for a Speaker of the House to be beaten, just ask Tom Foley, in their congressional election. They're just one of 435 members of the House, don't you know? And she's got an opponent, a Republican named Deanna Lorraine, who's running against her. Deanna Lorraine is the author of Making Love Great Again, host of Winning the Culture War, and a Republican candidate for Congress in California's 12th. Deanna Lorraine, thanks for joining us on the Dan Proft Show. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So I guess, you know, just start with your background for a minute. A relationship expert, have you offered to maybe do some couples counseling with President Trump and Nancy Pelosi?
I should definitely do that. That would be great. That's something that I think they desperately need.
Per the tearing up of the speech, a little bit, and then a lot of bit on Tuesday night. How did you react to that? How do you think San Francisco reacted to that?
You know what? It's hard to say because about half of the people here are so brainwashed, and they don't even want to listen to anything. They're just so heavily indoctrinated, and they think that Nancy Pelosi is a hero. And then, of course, there's a lot of people that are waking up. They're waking up to the lies and the deception.
Well, right. I mean, I guess that would be the obvious question to ask. A district that returns Nancy Pelosi to Congress over and over and over again, you figure Nicolas Maduro could be elected there, but a Republican never could. And so what's the basis for your candidacy?
Well, you know, here's the thing. If we don't fight in tough blue districts, then we're never going to win. You know, we're just we can't just wave the white flag of surrender. We've got to fight. We've got to throw ourselves in the fire. And if we didn't fight, then we would never have gotten President Trump. So we absolutely have to put ourselves out there. We cannot let our country fall to socialism. You know, this is just like, if you could see San Francisco, it used to be so beautiful and so charming. And so much of it has just fallen down the way of cultural rot with Nancy Pelosi at the helm of it.
Yeah,
you can see the kind of childish displays that and behavior that she's up to right now, instead of prioritizing the real needs, the real issues of real Americans that they're dealing with.
Yeah, is that a possible path to perhaps at least get an audience with people that are otherwise disinclined to not want to listen to anybody with an R next to their name? Just the what's happening locally in places like San Francisco with the homeless population, with frankly the cleanliness situation, just quality of life for the price point, maybe that's something that is postpartisan.
Absolutely. You know, people are finally waking up to those issues that, you know, all Americans should be concerned with, and people, residents of San Francisco should be concerned with. You know, the homelessness, the feces on the streets, the drugs, the mental health issues, those are things that are really affecting everyone, and these are things that we can all be able to get behind. And it doesn't really matter if you're left or right. And those are the kinds of common sense quality of life issues that I've been championing.
And so that's one aspect of your candidacy. What else motivated you to get into this race and to take up this fight specifically against Pelosi?
I believe that Nancy Pelosi is just the epitome of cultural rot in America, and she's leading us down a very dangerous path of socialism and division and nonstop, you know, hatred of America, hatred of our president. And we're at a time where America is already so divided right now. And the way that she runs San Francisco is the way that she wants to run America. I just can't have that, not under my watch. And I feel like we just need to fight before our country goes down the way of San Francisco, of the worst parts of San Francisco. I stand by our president. I stand by his decisions. And I want our country and this district of San Francisco to be strong, to be safe, to be prosperous and healthy. And we need more people in office that are going to champion that are going to stand for our Constitution, that are going to stand for American values. We just have too many traitors in office, too many socialists in office, and too many of these soft Republicans that do not have any backbone. We can't have that anymore. You know, we can see with Mitt Romney going against the president. I mean, it's just ridiculous. You know, we need real patriots in office.
And I'm
a real patriot.
And as part of this effort, too, to revitalize the Republican Party at the local and state level in California, I know what that's like living in Illinois, but the need to revitalize locally and at a statewide level, but to help revitalize nationally.
Absolutely. You know, we actually need strong legislation that is going to create stronger families, strong borders. You know, we need to get rid of these open border policies that liberals are championing right now. That is just going to do so much danger to America.
She is Deanna Lorraine. She is the author of Making Love Great Again, host of Winning the Culture War, Republican candidate for Congress in California's 12th, and her website for more information on her candidacy and campaign, DeannaForCongress.com. Deanna Lorraine, thanks so much for joining us on the Dan Prof Show. Appreciate it.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Take care. Crazy about a shot at this man.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to The Dan Proft Show. President Trump had a little acquittal celebration party at the White House today with all of the assembled Republicans, as well as his legal defense team and other relevant parties, members of the cabinet, the vice president, and started out by celebrating the best headline he's ever received from the WAPO, the Amazon Post.
I've done things wrong in my life, I will admit. Not purposely, but I've done things wrong. But this is what the end result is.
You could take that home, honey. Maybe we'll frame it.
Well, there you go. It's a collector's item. And a little bit later on in his remarks, he gave a more expansive explanation for what he actually did and what the Democrats actually did. What he actually did with respect to the conversations he had about military aid to Ukraine and his, you know, relative incredulity that they were able to take that phone call he had with Zelensky on July 25th as far as they did.
Tell me, why isn't Germany paying money? Why isn't France? Why isn't United Kingdom paying money? Why aren't they paying money? Why are we paying the money? Is that a correct statement, Mike? I say, find out what the hell's going on. And I told that to all of my people, OMB. I said, I asked that question. How much is Germany paying? Why isn't Germany paying? Why is the United States always the sucker? Because we're a bunch of suckers. But that's turning around fast. But it makes it harder when stuff like this happens because you want to focus and you want to focus perfectly. Think what we could have done if the same energy was put into infrastructure, prescription drug prices. Think of what we could have done. And I'm now talking both sides. Think of what we could have done. If we had the same genius, because it's genius, I will say it's genius on the other side, maybe even more so, because they took nothing and brought me to a final vote of impeachment. That's a very ugly word to me. It's a very dark word, very ugly. They took nothing. They took a phone call that was a totally appropriate call. I call it a perfect call because it was. And they brought me to the final stages of impeachment. But now we have that gorgeous word. I never thought a word would sound so good. It's called total acquittal.
Total acquittal. And in so doing, brought them to that final stage of impeachment. Nothing, as President Trump said. In so doing, as Lindsey Graham said on the Senate, the well of the Senate, they've unleashed the partisan forces of hell on a go-forward basis. So we'll see the impact of the precedent that the Democrats have set. But President Trump, much like at the prayer breakfast earlier in the day, prior to his celebration at the White House, he addressed Mitt Romney, he addressed Nancy Pelosi, and this time by name, it was rather genteel. It was in thanking Mike Lee for his support, the senior senator from Utah, but with a message about the junior senator from Utah to the people of Utah.
And right at the beginning, he knew we were right, Mike, and I appreciate it very much. You're just fantastic. And say hello to the people of Utah and tell them, I'm sorry about Mitt Romney. I'm sorry. Okay?
I think it must mean I'm sorry for endorsing Mitt Romney against my better instincts. Also addressing Nancy Pelosi. This was less fun and more pointed. Pelosi and Schiff, these Democrats, they're lousy Pauls, says the president, but they do two things or exhibit two things.
You know, all my life I wasn't in politics, but I'd say if you're a politician, you want to say we're going to lower taxes. They want to raise taxes. So they have open borders, sanctuary cities, raise everybody's taxes, get rid of everybody's health care, 180 million people in the United States, and they're really happy. And we're going to give you a health care that's going to cost more money than the country could make in 30 years if it really does well. That's 1 year. So I've always said they're lousy politicians, but they do two things. They're vicious and mean, vicious. These people are vicious. Adam Schiff is a vicious, horrible person. Nancy Pelosi is a horrible person. And she wanted to impeach a long time ago when she said, I pray for the president. I pray for the president. She didn't pray. She may pray, but she prays for the opposite. But I doubt she prays at all. And these are vicious people. But they do two things. They stick together. Historically, I'm not talking now. They stick together like glue. That's how they impeached, because they had whatever the number is, 220 people. So if they don't lose anybody, they'll be able to impeach anybody. You could be George Washington. You could have just won the war, and they say, let's get him out of office. And they stuck together, and they're vicious as hell. And they'll probably come back for more.
And they'll probably come back for more, but maybe not. We'll see. We'll see what the landscape looks like for Democrats when the smoke clears. John Hinderaker, our friend, writing over at powerlineblog.com about the long national nightmare being over. Maybe. Although he writes that now when the smoke does begin to clear, I don't think Democrats will like the landscape that comes into focus. Their Iowa caucuses were a laughingstock. They made fools of themselves, Pelosi especially, during Trump's State of the Union speech. And most seriously, they don't have a presidential candidate. Biden's in free fall. The party elders, such as they are, concede that Bernie would be a disaster. Will they turn to Mayor Pete? Will Michael Bloomberg be their savior? Will Hillary Clinton or John Kerry come out of retirement? I think they're grasping at straws. They're grasping at straws in a lot of areas. Their nominee for president of the United States, the agenda that House Democrat leadership is going to have, the majority party in the House, the approach they're going to take to the president for the next 10 months leading up to the November election. CNN was talking about it this morning, that Nancy Pelosi feels like she'd been bottled up over the last several months with this impeachment matter. And now she feels free to be who she really is, to tell the president, to exhibit to the president what she really thinks about him. Okay. All right. If you think Tuesday night is going to help you win swing districts, then something President Trump said today to Kevin McCarthy may yet come to pass in November. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. This is the Dan Prof Show.
the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. I just want to continue on our discussion of what the president had to say at his acquittal celebration at the White House this afternoon. Two things that are important and relatively easy to understand for the American who isn't just sort of blinded by, brainwashed by Trump antipathy. And it was the fairness or unfairness of the process. A lot of people who have, and Americans generally, who have this innate appreciation for fairness or unfairness. People should be given a fair shake. People should be given due process. American people generally don't like to see anybody railroaded, even if it's somebody they don't like. Even if it's somebody they think is guilty, you still have a process to follow because the only way you ensure that you prevent the innocent from being convicted or you make it much less likely, thinking about this in a criminal sense, is that you follow due process to get to the truth, not just to railroad somebody because they're unpopular or because the evidence suggests they're guilty. You still have to go through a process. One side doesn't just get to declare them guilty and that's the end of it. And so President Trump's remarks today about fairness and the process.
And we were treated unbelievably unfairly. And you have to understand, we first went through Russia, Russia, Russia. It was all bull. We then went through the Mueller report, and they should have come back one day later. They didn't. They came back 2 years later, after lives were ruined, after people went bankrupt, after people lost all their money.
And, by the way, you still have Democrats, including in swing districts like suburban Chicago, Sean Casten, spinning Russian collusion yarns, trying to rewrite what the Mueller report actually concluded, what Mueller's testimony indicated. Not a single American colluded with the Russians, which necessarily includes President Trump. That has not stopped a number of Democrats and certainly their co-conspirators on the cable news channels and in the D.C. press corps from continuing to make these unfounded allegations. President Trump also pointed out something else about fairness. It was just sort of the inherent conflictual nature of this, the silly political nature of this to a certain extent. I pointed this out during the process, but it bears repeating. You know, these impartial jurors. Impartial.
This was crooked politics. This was crooked politics. How about all these people? They're running for office. They're saying the worst things about me, like 8 senators on the Democrat side. Most of them got wiped out. You know, they got their 1% or less. Most of them got less. They decided to go home. Let's go back to California. Let's go back to wherever they came from. Let's go back to New York. How about that one? Our New York Senator Gillibrand.
Well, right. I mean, the point is, you got all these people running against Trump, running for the job that he has, saying all these awful things, convicting him in the court of public opinion before there was a witness called, before there was a hearing held. And then we're supposed to believe that they are impartial assessors of the case in chief presented by both the prosecution and the defense. What a joke. Thank you for joining us on the Dan Proft.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.